this in the context of significant in private sector innovation and social sector innovation in increasing access and quality. And there's a whole series of challenges that we're looking at here at CSIS. One of the challenges is the issue of that there's been an increasing amount of focus on basic education and basic education access. And I think there's been a lot of progress in that area. At the same time, there's also a major youth bulge. And my friend Ritu Sharma, who runs the Youth Prosperity and Security Initiative that has been in partnership with IYF, is looking at this very issue. And so we're really fortunate that she's going to be moderating this panel today. We're also doing this in the context of an increasing amount of public sector dollars in Africa. The largest funder of education aren't official donors, it's actually governments. We did a study looking at UN data and looked at the amount of taxes that have been collected in Africa in the last 15 years has increased something like fivefold. There's now, as of 2012, this is UN data, there are taxes and fees collected by African governments was about $500+ billion. And that includes oil, gas, and mining revenues. That includes the rising middle class. That includes companies participating in the formal sector paying taxes. And ODA, foreign aid, was about one-tenth of that, about $50 billion. So charity matters, ODA matters, philanthropy matters, but the decisions of governments also matter. So to the extent that at the same time, we can't wait for the political will and we can't wait for governments to make necessarily the most enlightened decisions with those resources. And we've got a large cohort of people, and that's why we need social innovation, we need private sector innovation, including for-profit innovation to deal with issues of access, to deal with issues of quality, to deal with access issues of workforce development. And so we have to think about things like taxes, we have to think about things by local governments, we have to think about individual giving, we have to think about private philanthropy, we have to think about the role of the private sector, we have to think about private for-profit investment, and we have to think about social enterprise. And I think we'll hear some of that in this discussion today. So we've got big challenge. There's been some progress. There's also been significant innovation that we're going to hear about, but we've got ways to go. And so I think this is an interesting problem-solving conversation as opposed to this is a crisis and what do we do about it. There's been a lot of thought and effort put in this in the last 15 years and significant progress, but we've got a ways to go. So I'm going to, it's really a privilege and honor to turn over the panel to my friend Ritu Sharma. Thank you for being here. I'm going to ask the panelists to come up. We have some very thoughtful people. We have John Rendell, who's the CEO of PEAS, which is a social enterprise. We have Harry Petrinos, who's been the lead economist for education. I think has a new role at the World Bank, he can tell you about, as well as we have a senior executive from IYF, our partner on youth issues, Peter Shires, who's come from Baltimore. But the person who's come the farthest is my new friend John Rendell from PEAS, so we really appreciate him coming from the UK to be with us. So I'm going to turn the floor over to my friend and colleague, Ritu. If you want to learn more about what Ritu's up to, she's got a website called whatyouthwant.csis.org, whatyouthwant.csis.org. Ritu, the floor is yours. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan. Thank you all for coming. Really appreciate your being here. And is it next week or the week after? It's the week after where the Sustainable Development Goals are going to be blessed, and then they will let the bulls out of the cage, and we'll rally for the next 15 years. So this event is actually was created because John was coming to town to be with us in Washington, and I imagine you're staying here for the next couple of weeks.
Actually, only 2 days.
Only 2 days?
Only 2 days.
You're not going to be a part of the whole New York extravaganza.
Not, I'm afraid. No, I'm scared of bulls.
You have actual work to do. So we're delighted to have you, and it was a wonderful reason and opportunity to get together some of these experts from the World Bank and from IMF to talk about secondary education, what's happening in that space, how can we improve it, how are we going to take secondary education to scale to reach the hundreds of millions of young people who are coming up in Africa, Latin America, and Asia. And so to start, what I would like John to do is to tell us a little bit about the model that he created at Pease when he was actually a college student, a young social entrepreneur, and how that model is not only innovative, but self-financing, gets good results from the educational attainment of children. And so we're going to jump off from there, but then we will go bigger than that and look at some of the broader implications of the system. So please, John, tell us about Pease.
Thanks, Ritu. And thank you very much, Dan, for hosting us today. Pease is, to put it in very simple sense, a network of charter schools in Uganda and Zambia. The only difference is are that there's no charter school systems in a couple of these countries. And so we are having to help governments create the regulatory environment as we go, create public-private partnerships. And the other key difference, I guess, is that we're building schools from scratch. There's this huge wave of kids on the back of the Millennium Development Goal coming through primary school and then facing this kind of educational cliff. Enrollment in Uganda is 93%, and enrollment at primary level and at secondary level, enrollment's 25%. So there's this huge drop-off. And what we're doing is we're going to villages in rural Uganda and rural Zambia. We're finding places where 250 or more kids are finishing primary school, not going on to secondary school, and then we are buying the land, we're building a school, and we're trying to run those schools on these public-private partnerships and very low fees. So we've just signed a deal with the Zambian government where they are going to give us 90% of the cost of educating a child in a government school for each child we educate there, and we're now in the process of scaling up and building out that country. In Uganda, we're educating 1% of the kids who are educated at secondary level there. After we launch the school, we provide a mixture of different support and supervision services. So some of them very boring things. That, you know, one of the things that people in education and outside education jump to is let's sort out the classroom. Mm-hmm. But before you've sorted out the classroom, you need the classroom. You know, you need the building, and then you need the financial systems in a school and the administrative systems to be strong. Then you need the teachers to be motivated. One of the biggest issues in education in the countries we work in, especially in the public sector, is teachers are seconded from a central government payroll. When they're sacked, well, they're just not sacked. And if a head teacher wants a teacher to be sacked, it takes a huge amount of time and effort from the head teacher. When they are sacked, they're just shifted to another school. And between the sacking and the replacement, they're still paid. So there's very, very low incentive to turn up, and it means that in Uganda, absenteeism is about 28%. Obviously, that's completely debilitating for a school to have 28% teacher absenteeism. So there's a huge issue there. So motivating teachers is a key thing that we do. We audit the school, financial audit. We inspect the school, and then we help the school create a school improvement plan and support that with a school support plan. And our experts in Uganda work to help the schools improve year on year. The grand plan is the schools themselves are financed locally, and in the future, Pease Uganda, this support structure, and Pease Zambia will be supported by fees from the schools. So under this new Zambia deal, we'll be able to do that so that we actually require no philanthropic input into the network as a whole, and we'll then just need the capital to build out this big network so the whole thing runs as a social enterprise. That's kind of Pease. I guess the important thing to say is we don't just want it to be about Pease. And I'm here today with Harry and lots of people in this room really thinking about the bigger picture, the kind of systemic change. And for us, our long-term theory of change is that we create these bilateral PPPs, which act as precedent setters. The government, in creating a bilateral PPP with us, actually establishes a regulatory environment, and we support the establishment of the right regulatory environment so that loads of other organizations can do the same thing. Who are they? It remains to be seen, whether it's private for-profit organizations, whether it's not-for-profits, whether we can actually just see government schools being run in different ways. But the grand plan is that each of these countries develops public-private partnerships where the government funds but doesn't necessarily run all of the schools that are needed. And, you know, the need is huge, both on the access and on the quality side.
Mm-hmm. So a really interesting model with this blend of public-private financing, and I think we'll be curious to watch how this all rolls out and develops in Zambia. Harry, can you now take us to the big picture in terms of where you sit at your perch at the World Bank and your expertise around the world in Latin America and in other places, looking at the systemic issues around education, both primary and secondary. But how do we take models like this one and scale them up so we're not reaching just 1% of the students, but we're reaching 98% of the students in a population of, you know, between 0 and 15, which is, you know, the wave is coming towards us. Can we pull this off in the next 15 years to scale up to where we're getting kids the skills that they need? How are we going to do that?
Sure, good question. Education is facing a, I would say, double challenge of trying to get all the children in school. We had as a goal basic education or primary schooling. We're going to move in the next couple of weeks to adopting the goal of universal secondary schooling. So it's a tall order. The other part of the challenge is making sure that children are not only present in school, but learning something. And we know the issue has been over the last couple of decades that we have been very successful at getting children in school, but learning issues are present. So we know from the few countries that participate in international assessments like PISA that for middle-income countries, about half the students tested, these are children in school, at least up to about grade 9, they're not able to function in the world of work. They lack the basic cognitive skills that we're expecting in the 21st century. And still, there are 59 million children out of school at the primary school level, and about 250 million children, according to UNESCO, who cannot read or write, even though many of them have been to school. So a very tall order as we go forward to the goals for 2030. And at the same time, education has a very high return for the individual, for their family, for society at large. For the individual themselves, another year of schooling raises earnings by at least 10%, in many low-income countries, maybe by 20%. So there's a huge return to getting that education. One area where there is significant promise of helping us achieve education for all and quality education, especially for the poor, and building on what John just shared with us, is what role is it for the private sector? And we know that there is a growing private presence, and by private I mean not non-state, could be NGOs, could be churches, could be other religious organizations, and even for-profits. Between 1990 and 2010, in low-income countries, enrollments in private primary schools doubled from less than 11% to more than 22% now. So there is a growing presence. And if I could share three examples of where we've seen interesting PPPs and the promise of PPPs, I would start with the case of Pakistan, where we've worked extensively with governments in both Sindh and Punjab to put in place some very interesting, innovative public-private partnership programs that the governments themselves had designed, initiated, conceived, and are helping to implement. In the case of Sindh, the government is using the existing private schools to leverage improvements in quality and to get more children into school. We're helping in implement that program, but also to look at the impact of that program. And we're finding that students in these low-cost schools are receiving an education at a fraction of the cost of public schools and learning at least as much and often more than students in public schools. Another interesting model comes from the Punjab in Pakistan, where government was faced with this growing number of private schools that were targeting the poor, and they weren't sure about the quality of these schools. Their response was to create a foundation, the Punjab Education Foundation, which would support these schools, give them incentives, resources, test the students, follow up, in an effort to improve the quality. And through our evaluation support of this program, we found that they were able to improve access to quality schooling, and to increase the resources that these students were getting. So at a fraction of the cost of public schools, the students in the Punjab Education Foundation schools were learning more and learning at a rate that was higher than public schools. The incentive in that program was the resources they would get for passing the tests and the extra resources for teacher support. The poor schools, we found out, would cease to exist or they'd be taken over by the more successful schools. Another very interesting model is the Andhra Pradesh India voucher experiment, very large scale, probably the largest experiment we have of a voucher program. And there the researchers found that the private schools were able to teach as much or slightly better than what was happening in public schools, but at a third of the cost, which led one of the lead researchers to ask, how much better could private management be if they had three times the resources? The lesson to be learned from the Andhra Pradesh case is that with accountability and systemic support, there could have been very large gains in learning that would have spread not just to the private schools, but the public system as well. An emerging public-private partnership may come out of the Kenya example, where Bridge International Academies, which runs about 400 primary schools, both in Kenya and Uganda, supported by many organizations, including Mark Zuckerberg, Bill Gates, and the like. They have created a very innovative model, very low-cost model. It's a for-profit school program that leverages technology to both support teachers, to make sure that learning takes place. And we are supporting that model with an independent evaluation that in the next 2-3 years will have solid results about what the impact of that school program is. And if they are getting similar results, again, it would be at a fraction of the cost of public schools. So there are many examples that are emerging in the world, especially in low-income countries, of innovative uses of the private sector to support learning for the poorest. What we need to do is find out which models work and for whom, at what cost, and how could they be implemented in a way that makes sense. And the goal isn't simply to have more private schools, but the goal is to learn what are they doing and what can be taken from the private sector to the public sector and treat the education system as a holistic model of learning. What works for private schools may work for public schools, and therefore it's beneficial to the system. If we look at it that way, then the goal of education for all, even for secondary education, becomes a little bit more attainable, giving us a bit more clarity on what we need to do and at what cost. The biggest unknown is how can we expand secondary schooling for all and in a way that's cost effective and that will improve learning outcomes, especially for the poorest.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. And a very hopeful, I think, diagnosis given the examples that you've worked on in Asia. I mean, I wouldn't have picked Pakistan as the easiest place to work, but very glad to hear that there are some things that are getting traction. One of the things we talked about at our lunch a little bit beforehand was how most often technical vocational educational training is separate from secondary schooling. And in many countries, young people don't have the luxury. If they have the luxury of going to secondary school, they may not have the added luxury of going to a technical school. It's either or often. And Peter, be helpful, I think, for everyone to hear about how International Youth Foundation is working with the government of Tanzania to try to bring these systems together, to try to integrate, create these complementarities, and engage the private sector in that, not just in terms of employing these students, but financing the whole thing, which I think is very interesting.
Sure, yeah. Thanks, Ritu. And again, thanks to Dan also for the invitation to be here. Let me add a couple of, to build on what John and Harry have said, a couple other elements to the discussion. One is that for the vast majority of students in secondary education, if they get into secondary education, that will essentially be the end of their educational journey in any kind of formal way. The percentage that go on to any kind of tertiary education is minuscule in most African countries. So one of the things that we've been focused on is how do we take advantage of that moment to ensure that students are provided the skills they need to transition into the workforce. And so that's why we have focused much of our work on the vocational training system, where those skills are imparted to young people. I think that a couple of major challenges that vocational training systems around the world face, and we find the same thing in the work we're doing in Tanzania, is first the poor perception of vocational training by students, by parents, and it actually seeps into the system itself. It's often seen as a very second or third alternative to university education or traditional secondary school education. So this is one of the challenges that that we're confronting, is how do we change the perception of vocational training as something that actually leads to very good jobs, which in fact is the case. Again, to build on what Harry said, the returns to vocational training are significant in terms of improved wages from those who graduate. A second issue is the quality of the vocational training systems. We're working with public sector vocational training systems in Tanzania and Mozambique and a number of countries in Latin America, and we find a set of systemic challenges in terms of the quality of those systems, and that's the effectiveness of the teachers. It's the ability of the teachers to actually keep up with industry trends. It's the low quality of the facilities. It's the relevance or the lack of relevance of the curriculum to what industry needs are. So there's a whole set of challenges that relate to the quality of vocational training. And the third challenge we face is a fairly systematic disengagement of industry from the vocational training system, despite the fact that, on the one hand, if you go and talk to private employers, they will say that one of the challenges they face is the difficulty in finding qualified workers to hire. And so in Africa, where you have an oversupply of candidates, even in those kind of environments, they're not finding the level of competence that they're looking for in terms of hiring new people. And that's a combination of foundational skills, numeracy, literacy, the relevant technical skills. But what they often place at the top of the list of what they're not finding are attitudinal skills or social-emotional skills or soft skills or whatever you want to call them. Those kinds of skills related to critical thinking, related to teamwork, related to communication. So and yet, as I say, despite this, we find this systematic disengagement of industry from real partnerships with vocational training. And in Tanzania, it's even more ironic, if you will, because in Tanzania, the private sector pays a skills levy, which is essentially a payroll tax. So they're actually paying for something like 87% of the budget of the vocational training system, and yet still are not as deeply engaged or engaged at all with that system to make sure that they're getting a return on their investment in terms of some basic things like working with the vocational training system to make sure the curriculum actually is relevant to what their needs are. And this is most often successful on a sector-by-sector basis. There's a lack of providing on-the-job training to graduates or students at the vocational training system so they get practical application of their training. And there is also a lack of the ability to provide teachers that same kind of industry experience, so the teachers also don't just have whatever theoretical training they have, but actually also keep up with the industry trends. So there's a series of ways in which industry is, but could and needs to engage much more deeply, not only as what they're doing right now, investing in the system through the payroll tax, but engaging with the system in partnerships so that their hiring needs and employers actually are met more effectively by the vocational training system, and in the same way so that the students are prepared to move into jobs, whether those jobs are in the formal economy, in the informal economy. And then there's a whole other issue around entrepreneurship and self-employment, which is another challenge that vocational training systems need to confront, but I'll leave that one for now.
Yeah, we can rack up the list of challenges. One of the things that is a sort of a sticky wicket in all of this with education, primary, secondary, and technical vocational training, is the challenge around teachers, right? The getting the right incentives, the right training, the right feedback mechanisms, the right accountability mechanisms. And could each of you talk a little bit about how you have tackled that, or how you have looked at it? Particularly, you were mentioning some of the success that you've had with the schools in Pakistan in terms of an accountability loop leading to resources or not for the schools. So if you want to start, Harry, and then we'll come back to you and finish with Peter.
Sure. The example in the Punjab, I mean, the foundation schools are an advantage because they are not direct employees of the state. The schools are in charge. And what the association did was, the foundation did, was to give incentives to the schools to improve. How they did that was up to the schools. If the schools were showing the willingness to improve, they got resources, including training, management training, school finance training, and they could take advantage of that to also train their teachers. But they could also replace teachers if they had to. The program didn't dictate how they would improve their results, but they did. So the resources were used, obviously, by schools for training of various types of personnel at the school level, but the incentive mechanism was the improvement. We can't often do that in public systems, and in fact, in many public systems, we don't even measure the learning that takes place, let alone create a system that would create some sort of feedback loop on information and accountability for the schools. I worked on an experiment in Mexico, in the state of Colima, where the schools were given access to learning outcomes of their own students by school, by grade, by teacher. The information already existed. All the program did was to highlight which schools were doing well, which weren't doing well, and to offer the ones that weren't doing well extra support. So in the language of assessment, these would be low stakes examinations. In fact, there was a incentive if you weren't doing well. The interesting thing about the experiment was that even though the test scores were there for at least 5 years, schools weren't aware of them, and they certainly weren't aware of how they were doing compared to the rest of the state. The program, just by alerting people, raised scores by at least 10 points. No other intervention but letting schools know that they weren't doing as well as others. Why would that help? We know from other industries that simply informing people about their performance also leads to improvements. Restaurants have had the hygiene letters. Those restaurants have improved on hygiene because of the grade they want. Nobody wants the C or whatever the low grades are. In the energy sector, some of you may receive your bill, and it tells you how much you consume compared to your neighbors. That was an experiment, and it led to significant reductions in energy consumption just by letting people know how they were doing compared to, in this case, neighbors. So information is key, and that's the starting point. If we don't know, if the teachers don't know how they're doing, how their students are doing, it's hard to expect them to improve. The next step would be to use that information, and it can be done in low-stakes environments. We have examples of that. It could be high-stakes if nothing else works, but information is a foundation for that.
Basic, very basic. Yeah, John, do you want to talk about P's and the teacher aspect of that?
Yeah, the first thing I say is I agree with nearly everything you said, Harry. I think information is very, very important. what you're talking about is a shift from accountability for inputs, which is very widespread, particularly in some of these countries with lower resources in the public sector, to outcomes. To do that, you have to get the information about outcomes right. And if your methodology is wrong and you're measuring absolute outcomes without taking into account the sorts of kids who are actually in the school, then you have huge risks of creating incentive structures which lead to gaming. And I'm sure the methodology in the things Harry's talking about didn't do that, but that's very, very important mm-hmm. that these outcomes assessments are value added rather than absolute.
Which by that you mean improvement in children's
exactly,
performance.
Exactly, yeah. And to do that well, you either have to rely on the quality of the external examination systems mm-hmm. in a country or use one of the international testing regimes to just concentrate on how's literacy moving. Mm-hmm. Going down to the micro and actually talking about maybe what inputs mm-hmm. do work, I think one of the simple things we do is we don't pay as much as government schools in Uganda, but we pay people on time every month. Mm-hmm. And it makes a big difference.
Absolutely.
Certainty of income. It's motivated. Then I think actually providing opportunities to develop and mm-hmm. certificate that development mm-hmm. is very, very important as well. It's a motivating factor. We provide teacher accommodation in our schools. Mm-hmm. So we've done things which respond to what teachers are saying is important rather than the unionized high mm-hmm. expectations, maybe. Mm-hmm. And we've actually, a lot of these countries have a small group of unionized teachers on the public payroll earning completely different amount than the wider market of mm-hmm. of teachers who are equally qualified and actually able to get those results, but just outside that this kind of internal group, which is interesting. I think in terms of how to actually help teachers do better, our experience is that workshops don't work. It's a common phrase in education. Mm-hmm. These sort of having big sessions of learning pedagogy outside the classroom is much, much less effective than having people that know what good looks like, sitting out down with the teacher, mm-hmm. asking them to trial one new thing mm-hmm. in the lesson, feeding back on that, having a sit down afterwards, mm-hmm. and then embedding it over time. And mm-hmm. it's something which is, you know, works across the world as the main way in which you improve teaching, because you have to develop the muscle memory of teaching. Mm-hmm. Just knowing how to teach well is almost, you know, or very rarely effective. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Makes sense. And Peter, in the vocational setting, how does this work with the teachers? Are there enough qualified teachers in that setting? How do you find them? How do you incentivize them?
Well, we are working primarily with public sector institutions. So all the problems that you talked about, Harry, in that environment, you know, certainly exist. I'd just say two things. One is, one of the things that we've done related to the point around information is gotten employer feedback from those that have been hired, the graduates that have been hired, and used that feedback for the teachers to inform what's working, what's not working, where are those that have been hired by companies doing well compared to their peers, where are they less strong. And so this provides that kind of outcome information that's critical to providing feedback. The other thing that I would say is critical is the life skills component, because one of the things that we work with the institutions is the development of a strong life skills curriculum, which is a very interactive, hands-on, experiential learning curriculum. And so we actually work intensively with teachers to train them, to coach them, in the delivery of the life skills program, which, as John was saying, it's not something that just happens overnight. Mm-hmm. We have to go back and do follow-up. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is not only does it have an impact on the way in which life skills are delivered, right, because you can't stand up and lecture to a class about good communication skills. It just won't work. And the whole curriculum is...
So people do it every
well,
day.
Well, yes, and many of these places, that's the way they did it. But what's interesting is not only does it even have an impact on the way then life skills are delivered, but teachers, and this is just anecdotal, are telling us it's also influencing the way in which they deliver their other subject matter. So right. We found this to be a critical tool, not only in the delivery of life skills, but mm-hmm. potentially having broader implications as well.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about a little bit about the scale-up. How is this going to be scaled? I mean, there's various scenarios of, you know, government financing, and Dan was just telling us at lunch about the increases in, and as he was up here, about the increase in domestic resource mobilization and tax revenue and all of that. Is that going to pour into education? I mean, or is it, and how are we going to get those incentives right in terms of 95% of the budget, education budget, going into the teacher salaries for which they're not accountable for anything? You know, that is a fundamental flaw in the system. Is it that we just, and I'm being a little provocative here, is it that we just need more private enterprise to come in, profit and non-for-profit, and attract the students away from the public schools until that system implodes on itself? Is that the direction we ought to go to get to the speediest delivery of good public education? Or how do we change the majority of education around the world? I mean, in this country included. No, I mean, or excluded. You can take that or leave it. But we have many of the same problems here.
In answer to your provocative question, okay. No. I think that one of the things we were talking about earlier on is, you know, while there's a quarter of kids in secondary school, by far the most important thing, and this is, you know, Uganda specifically, by far the most important thing is all hands on deck to get everyone mm-hmm. into school. So working out how to get the financing so it's pro-poor, so mm-hmm. that it gets people through primary school, it creates mm-hmm. credible opportunity to go to secondary school. All these countries, students face fees.
And you say that, do you mean in your system, fees, or for the whole entire system?
For the whole entire system, yeah. I think where private partners can play a role is by creating a wider plurality of provision so that the bar can be raised in the public sector. Through opportunities to share best practice, so that you potentially it can increase the total amount of capital flowing in mm-hmm. to the development of new schools. So I think the role of philanthropy is really in this field now catalytic. Mm-hmm. It might be to build new schools, which are then funded ad infinitum by the public sector. It might be to support structures that transfer best practice from one place to another. Mm-hmm. It might be to help governments create regulatory environments mm-hmm. which allow these plural providers to mm-hmm. be there and to sustain. But I really don't think the long-term solution is to move kids from the public sector to the private sector. I think mm-hmm. that the only way in the long run mm-hmm. We will have universal quality provision is if there's plural provision and that the private providers are able to drive up the quality of public mm-hmm. schools, mm-hmm. which will require some big policy change. And so there's a space there for help.
Yeah. And in your research or work at the World Bank, Harry, have you seen that halo effect of private provision then driving up the quality of public provision or not so much?
We've seen some of it. I think the model that sounds most like what we hope to see from the experience of PEAS and other mm-hmm. innovations is what happened in Colombia and Bogota back in the late 90s. The government decided that they had a challenge of quality education for the poor and very good elite schools for the rich. Mm-hmm. And the program was the government built 25 schools in poor areas of the city and then invited the top, mostly private schools, to bid to run those schools for 15 years. And they managed to improve outcomes in those schools. So the year-on-year gains are significant, and they've reached all the targets they had in their contracts. But also the schools surrounding, the public schools surrounding those schools also improved because of the competition effect. They weren't in direct competition. They wouldn't lose resources, but they knew what these schools were doing and wanted to prove they could do it as well. And the government ensured that there was the lessons were learned. I want to mention, I agreed with everything John said. I just want to add one point on going forward and the challenge that we have. Mm-hmm. I think someone mentioned the social development goals that will be agreed mm-hmm. to in a couple of weeks. There's how many goals? 17 goals, 169 indicators. So we have a lot of things that we're agreeing to, and if it was only up to ODA, there's no way that, what is it, $160 billion in ODA? There's no way that ODA is going to finance this. And the sources of finance are what's already being spent. Mm-hmm. There's at least $4.5 trillion spent on education every year. The fastest, globally, the fastest growing segments of that are test prep and technology. There is some misallocation of resources from what they're seeing as needs. So the test prep, preparing people to pass exams, because there's a lot of parental demand for that. Technology, because people are looking for ways to invigorate the system. But there are many things that we should be investing in the system that will make the improvements. There is an information gap, not just for teachers about how their students are performing, but what works in education. That's something that all of us need to work to improve.
Peter, do you want to add anything on this?
Well, I totally agree with the notion of, you know, we need all hands on deck here. We need a multiplicity of solutions to this issue. One of the things, again, drawing on our work in Tanzania, that we find working, again, with a governmental system is the importance also of donor coordination. There are at least 10 to 15 initiatives underway working with VETA, the Vocational Education and Training Authority in Tanzania, from the African Development Bank, bilateral donors, private sector, NGOs, and they're inundated with all these different, you know, one is doing the German dual apprenticeship system, and another is saying, you know, we need to develop an accreditation system, and another is saying, you know, you need to, you know, we're saying you need to improve your soft skills. There's a real need to coordinate these efforts so that there is not duplication, so there is efficiency, but also so that the sum is greater than each individual part. Mm-hmm. And I think it extends to looking at the system as a whole. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there is a piece of work focused on vocational, but one needs the larger perspective also of how these different pieces fit together, because one of the big challenges vocational training in Tanzania faces is the poor level of literacy and numeracy of the students coming into those systems. So the teachers spend the first year just getting them up to speed on that. So looking at this system as a whole on a country level, I think, is a critical need in this area.
And I mean, in a way, one of the things we wanted to do with this panel is to have some folks, you know, from different countries that are on the ground, innovators there. And I think IYF knows, you know, there are a number of young social entrepreneurs around the world who are innovating in their own countries with a total understanding of the problem, having gone through the education systems in those places, and are a rich source of solutions for this. So maybe next time we can integrate that. But ultimately, isn't that the role of the government, to be that coordinating force, to provide that? I mean, we're getting into aid effectiveness issues here, which is one of my favorite topics, but it is very relevant in the sense that whether it's education or anything else, you know, where should that locus of control be in providing that discipline to bring all the donors together? I mean, my sense is that ought to be the governments, and institutions like the World Bank can facilitate that. But just say a little bit about
I think it could and should be the government, but oftentimes the government doesn't play that role. I mean, it's interesting, in Tanzania right now, BG, British Gas, is actually very invested in the vocational training system, because they are going to be building a large liquefied natural gas facility, and they're looking at the construction needs with local content, local hires, and those skilled workers are simply not there. So they're actually taking a major role. I think the other point that you made, you know, this is something where young people themselves need to play a critical role in pushing and being advocates and holding governments and the private sector accountable for these systems. And so young people and the movements, university student movements, can play a critical role also in pushing for this kind of accountability and coordination.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Do you want to add on that?
I agree with you that governments should play a bigger role in the coordination, but I think that for many low-income countries, we expect too much of them.
Yeah.
And if you look at high-performing countries in terms of education, the central governments are doing much less than what we expect of low-income countries. So if you look at a country like the Netherlands, the central government doesn't provide any schooling. They they manage and supervise the system, they regulate, they don't actually provide that education. Whereas many of the low-income countries where we work, the minister is expected to hire all the teachers, train the teachers, take action at every school level. These aren't demands that we have. I come from Canada. We don't even have a Ministry of Education at the federal level. So we're asking these central governments in capacity-constrained environments to do way too much. I think having the support to manage the system, the whole system, not just the schools under the Ministry of Education, and provide the same time is too much for any government. So having
that has to be part of the solution.
Sure.
You know, making a system that makes sense, that decentralizes education. And I mean, you could talk about that all day long. That's one of your specialties. Well, I want to open it up to everybody here for your questions and comments. Join the conversation. Yes, please. We'll take one at a time, but if we get too much demand, I'll flip that to two or three at a time. But here in the white shirt in the front, please. Thank you. Could you say that into the microphone, please?
Thank you. Martha Saldinger with Winrock International. I'm interested in dimensions of secondary ed in rural areas where provision is sparser and the gender dimensions of that. And also would be interested in sort of the relevance piece and whether we really need to have a sharp divide between vocational education and an academic education at the secondary level. Because if we want education to be relevant, maybe there needs to be a blend and we don't need to be so compartmentalized. Thank you.
Great question. Yeah, why don't we take a few? We'll take second in the purple tie and then third in the green shirt. You want to turn that on? Thank you.
Thanks. Magdi Amin from IFC. Hi, Harry. Two questions, or hopefully related. First, what's gone on in Chile over the last few years? It'd be interesting to get your views. As I understand it, sort of a pushback on for-profit private education, not necessarily non-profit private education, with really quality as sort of the underlying theme. So if Chile was having a hard time holding, if I understand the story right, holding the private sector accountable for quality, what are the prospects for less capable governments in, around the world? Secondly, you mentioned technology, but we didn't go into it. After a few years now into this, are we seeing the real promise of scaling up good content and good teachers, or are there real issues there that we still need to think about?
Great, great question. So one last in the green shirt.
Thank you. Arushi Therve, education consultant. Thank you so much for your provocative questions on, is the goal to switch everyone over to private sector and let the public sector implode? Alternatively, how is it that we're not seeing more examples or experiments on providing education sector support services from the private sector? For example, why aren't we looking at data management coming out from the private sector? Why aren't we looking at more experiments on teacher professional development and certification by the private sector rather than the public sector taking on all the responsibilities? I would imagine there's a lot of room for efficiency and
Absolutely.
Private sector innovation in there. How is it that we're not seeing more experiments on that?
Mm-hmm. Great, all great questions. So, gender, who wants to take that on?
I'll start on that. So Martha was asking about rural gender and the complementarity of vocational. Mm-hmm. First of all, PEAS works in rural areas. We target areas where there's basically no other secondary school for miles around, but where there is demands of 250 or more kids. And I agree that in those areas, gender is a bigger issue. We've managed to get our girls' percentage up to 51%, a series of different combined interventions working with the Girls Education Challenge, which is a DFID fund. How you do that is probably...
That's a long... We can have a whole session on
another session. Yeah. The this issue of vocational, I totally agree. We have something called literacy and life skills, which is trying to kill two birds with one stone. And I don't see them as separate things. I think that the core secondary curriculum is absolutely foundational for other stuff. So I think that one, you know, all else being equal, you can't do anything without that. And then I think there's huge potential to kind of double the double, which is secondary. The private rate of return of secondary education is basically double someone's income. If you get vocational right, you double it again by making sure that they're able to move straight into the workforce either a formal or higher paying informal job. Or in the areas we work, where 90% of people are farmers, you just make sure that they're farming more productively and help them farm more productively, but also can manage the financial side of a farm well. So it's kind of, I really, really believe that the two things should be done together, partly because of Peter's worry that vocational is and probably will always be regarded as a second tier thing. And so you need to bring it in to make relevance work in those secondary schools.
If I can just build on that very quickly. I agree. And just on the gender issue, the poor perception of vocational training is even more severe for women who perceive vocational training as, you know, heavy manual labor kinds of occupations, traditional male occupations, carpentry, plumbing, these kinds of things. So you tend to find even lower levels of female participation in vocational training, and this is another element that needs to be overcome.
Mm-hmm. One of the important things on gender, you know, that I've looked at on education is the absolute criticality of getting girls into secondary school and through secondary school and into employment. Because one of the things that I've observed, particularly in Africa, is the negative feedback loop that now, since we have this generation that has been pushed into primary school, the poor returns, the bad results from that, parents are then have a disincentive to send the next girls even into the primary system, particularly if they don't see them coming out of secondary and into a job. And there's a little bit of a backlash going on in a number of places where girls are, it's not worth it. It's not worth it for a poor family to take that opportunity cost and put that girl child in school. So, you know, I there is an urgency, I think, from the gender perspective to really address these issues. Does anybody want to talk about Chile and the experience there?
Well, it's still evolving, so I'm not sure it's played out yet. Certainly, the issue is on the perceived equity issues that continue to this day in Chile. But at the same time, this is the highest performing country in Latin America, even though they're at the bottom of the OECD scale. And the flaw, I think, in the system as it was designed was that it allowed schools to select and to charge top-up fees. So you still had a built-in mechanism for inequality. That's been addressed through the reforms, and there's now an incentive to take in poorer students because of the resource they come with them. The other issue is that they left out the elite private schools from the system, so they're still an independent, high fee-charging segment, which is different from the universal sort of choice systems that you have in the Netherlands or Belgium, where all schools are part of the system. So there were some design issues in Chile, and a lot of the discussions going on now about the for-profit status, I think, are a reflection of that equity debate. But the point is well taken. If Chile's having difficulty regulating this, it will be a challenge in other countries. But yet we are seeing the Punjab and Sindh in Pakistan managing the system. They haven't created a universal voucher system yet, but they seem to be dealing with that. And there are some lessons that can be learned even from the experience in Chile. The question on technology and are we seeing the problems yet, I don't think we're seeing them yet. Even though there's a lot more that we know now about what technology can offer, we're still seeing implementation of these large-scale. A long time it was computers and then laptops, now it's tablets, rather than the solutions that we need to see. And much of the debate has been dominated by this public versus private on delivery, rather than are there some easy solutions to solving the management issue? There are many examples of where support services in the private sector and help improve the management of systems and certification. I was in China a couple of months ago. They have a near the university of near Peking University, a it's called a MOOC center, and it's companies that they're incubating that are offering solutions, not just MOOCs, but distance education and education management systems. All small private startups, we would call them, and they're already trying these out in public schools. So there's lots going on. It's not getting the attention that the tablet gets still for some reason. And certainly the debate has centered around this question of public versus private rather than how can the private sector help the public sector and what can we learn from some of these innovative models.
Yeah. One of my favorite examples of high tech for education is from Africa, where obviously children don't have access to pencils and paper and all of that, and they wanted to create a way for children to continue their learning outside of the classroom. And so women put educational math and reading on their kitenge and wore that around, different kinds around the house. And so kids had exposure to just the words, the letters, the symbols, the, you know, and I'm like, that is high tech as far as I'm concerned, you know? That's just as good as a tablet, if not better. So I also think that it would be helpful in this field and is in a lot of development fields that we expand our definition of what technology is and innovation is. It doesn't have to involve a plug. You know, it can be something very different. Do you want to talk about the question about is there private sector support and innovation to support the public system? Any comments on that?
One of the things we're looking at is whether we can just roll out the inspection services that we offer our schools on contract to governments and the audit services. It's something which the government doesn't do brilliantly itself at the moment. So that's not an example. It's an example of what could be if we decide to take that particular path. I think probably it's most likely with PEAS that we'll try and scale the wholly owned model, make a bigger bang, and then hopefully demand for some of the things that we're doing will flow out of the back of that. Just linking what Harry said on the issue about rural again and difficult groups, if PPPs are designed well, then they can target the poor through differential, you know, differential premiums. And I think particularly in rural areas where it's harder to get teachers to go and be happy and stay, it's reasonably easy centrally to just have a premium for children being educated in harder places, and that's one way that you can sort of systemically solve the issue over time.
Anyone else on the private sector engagement? And it seems to me that a lot of ODA money is focused on interventions for the government, the public sector education systems. I mean, certainly there's lots of contracting organizations that some of them in this very room that specialize in that exact area in terms of improving testing, improving management, teacher training, you know, all of the things that are done centrally that maybe shouldn't be done centrally but still are. And I would imagine from where you sit at the World Bank, that's a fair amount of what the bank education assistance is about, yes?
To some extent. I mean, we do support school systems and classroom. We're getting a lot closer to the classroom through some of the instruments that we have. But in recent years, we have tried to build on the systems approach. Our strategy is based on helping to look at education as a system, to consider all the elements and to design policy around that. So one of the tools that we've developed is a compendium of policies and what, through research, we found to be the policies associated with high-performing systems that are subject to policymakers' control. And we're disseminating that along with a tool to assess countries' adoption of those policies and if they're interested, what do they need to do to move in that direction. Mm-hmm. And that's helped us identify some of those systemic issues, including things like inspection that John mentioned, but also on the teacher issues to move not only to think about training, but also the selection and motivation of teachers.
Right.
And another example from the vocational area is something called the Global Apprenticeship Network, which is a private sector initiated initiative that is systematically looking at how can companies work with vocational training systems to make sure there are those practical on-the-job training opportunities built into whether they're public sector or private sector vocational training systems. So that's another kind of example, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Great. So there are a few. Yes, in the blue jackets, and then over here in the back with the red glasses, and then in the yellow, in the... So, yes. Please, go ahead, sir.
Okay. I'm Peter Joyce. I'm from RTI International. So I have a two-part thought that I'll try and put into a two-part question, I guess. So the first one is just the notion of what's the purpose of secondary education? So is it about social impact or is it about economic impact? And if you can remember well, I guess my answer is, you know, it's probably a Miller Lite beer commercial from the old days, you know, great taste, less filling. It's probably a bit of both. The second part of the thought is how much schooling is really necessary? So I know it's been mentioned that, you know, secondary ed is shown to have higher returns on the investment. But is that about a sort of a signaling device, a signaling mechanism, or is it even a reflection of socioeconomic factors? And then how much of secondary ed should really focus on being skills-driven so that we're using that level, whether it's lower secondary, upper secondary, you know, to an outcome, to a mm-hmm. a targeted purpose? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Did that
great
come out
questions.
As two,
that was
a two-part question?
No, that was three.
three.
That was the three-part question. Yeah. Please, over here in the back in the red glasses.
Hello. Can you hear me? Carol Grigsby. I'm with Women Thrive Worldwide, your alma mater. Yeah. Recently, I was in Addis at the Financing for Development Conference, and I found that a great number of the civil society organizations there, including some of Thrive's own Global South partners, really take a very, very dim view of public-private partnerships in the education sector. They tend to see it as a way of taking the pressure off governments and giving them an out, really, when it comes to accountability in the education sphere. So I'm just interested in what are your very, very best arguments to make in response to those types of concerns, which incidentally also go to issues such as school fees, but primarily they're concerned about this issue of quality in public sector education and keeping the pressure on governments to provide it. Thank you.
Yes, and one last question about.
Hello, I'm Barbara Simmons. I'm Dean of International Education at William V.S. Tubman University in Liberia. I'm a native Philadelphian, and this issue of education is just, thank you, Mr. Rendell, for saying don't just implode the public system. But I have to say, I still think about when I was in eighth grade in Philadelphia public schools, and I've always been one that loved school, that I got an A+, 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 and then when my parents moved to the suburbs, I got a D on my first paper. So this issue of quality is very important. Now, some public school teachers have said to me if they could operate without the constraints that they have, that charter schools can, they would get different results also. But I've also taught in a charter school, which is appalled, really, because this particular one had a very good reputation, but the head of it, she didn't say it to me, but there was an unwritten rule that you didn't give any student under C, a C, which students came to me and asked for help in terms of they knew once they got out of that school they didn't do very well in college. Has it changed? When I was in school, all the research said that the greatest predictor of student outcome is teacher preparation and the quality of the teachers. And how do we address that? And in Liberia, I had one of the women who is one of our cleaners to say to me that her son told her he does not want to go to the government schools because the teachers don't come to school. So she's taking multiple jobs so she can pay for him to go to the private schools. But still, to me, the bottom line is, what is the quality of education? And yet, I heard a program on NPR last week where this person was proposing that there not be schools because he had given, just left a computer in various parts. I think this was in India, and the students learned and excelled on how to do it. So how do we come together in a way that I'm not locked into public or charter, but what works? And certainly we know there's not going to be one size fits all. Thank you.
Great. All excellent questions. Start anywhere.
So I want to start with the last question. Thank you for that. And just on the point about charters, the idea of why were they adopted in this country was as a mechanism for experimentation and learning. They haven't really become that, but we have learned a lot through the successful charters especially. And in terms of learning, I think the best example was when Roland Fryer and others did their research of the high-performing chart of the so-called no excuse model. He offered any district in the country, any school district that would try this model, that he would come and evaluate it for free. And I don't know how many districts there are in the U.S., but can you guess how many took him up on this offer to get this free program and evaluation? One school, Houston Public Schools, took him up. He did the experiment with them. He gave a group of public schools the same freedoms and structure as the charter schools, and was able to replicate the results of the high-performing charter schools. So that is what the charters were supposed to be about, learning lessons for the public system. And this relates to what I would say is my answer to the question on the public-private partnerships, that this in no way lets the pressure off government. If anything, it increases it. Because we have many countries that have, in every country, there's some kind of independent school segment. Whether it's recognized or not, it's there. Whether it's funded by the public sector or not, it's there. And many countries are simply ignoring it and not even doing a very good job on the public schools. Having the public-private partnership model means that they're now responsible not just for the public schools, but for those private schools that they are somehow supporting. So I see it as an increase in their responsibility and accountability. And the countries that I mentioned earlier that don't provide any schooling but yet regulate the whole system, Netherlands, 70% of schools are private. They're all considered public in terms of responsibility, and the government can intervene in any of them. Same in Belgium, same in Ontario, same in many locales where there's less provision by the central authority, but certainly a lot more responsibility. So I see the argument being the opposite on public-private partnerships. And finally, one partial response to the question about the value of education. I think secondary schooling is one of the most difficult parts of the system to measure in terms of the returns. This is the level of education that you go to if you're successful at the primary school level. It's the level of education you need if you want to go to higher levels. When we measure the value of education by looking only at secondary school graduates, we get the lowest rates of return compared to primary and tertiary, because we're undervaluing the option value that you get from secondary schooling, namely that you can go on to higher levels of schooling. So it has a bigger value than we can measure. I think there's been enough studies to show that the value of education, including secondary schooling, isn't simply signaling, because we find a value for people with incomplete degrees as well as complete degrees. We see a value of education when people are sort of these natural experiments, when you increase the level of schooling required, people go simply because of the change in the law, we still get a rate of return. So I think there is definitely a value to education. On the purpose of secondary schooling, I think it's you're right, it's many different things. Even from an economic viewpoint, it's the further training that you can get through the system, through on-the-job training, through vocational programs, as well as learning those skills that will be necessary. But if the systems are only designed to select the best to go on to university, do academic studies, then we're, for the majority of people that don't go on to higher education, they're not going to be useful for them. So there is a need to rethink what we're getting out of secondary schooling. And I'm not sure what the answer is. There have been experiments where they've combined vocational with academic before. The result was that the rate of demand for higher education actually increased. So these superior vocational skills were translated into higher demand for higher education. But there is a need to bring in more of the skills that are needed. We have a vocational project in China, technical vocational high school, but they also teach non-cognitive skills, but they do it using Confucian teachings as a way to improve the non-cognitive skills of students.
Very interesting. Great. And then did someone want to address kind of the last question about, I mean, was it really about sort of the balance of public charter and the interaction between those? Am I getting that right? In short. I mean, I think we've discussed that a lot in terms of the crossover and feedback effects, or you know, at least how they are supposed to work.
I had a couple of points on the other two questions as well. The way I think about Harry's point about government responsibility is that there's always a doer and there's always a payer. And the doer is changing doesn't mean that the payer, the responsibility for the payer part needs to change, and it shouldn't. I think in the long run, the only way you can guarantee equitable, high-quality access for everyone mm-hmm. is if fees are zero and the government carries the can for that. And as Harry says, now increasingly the responsibility of making sure the doers are doing it right is a really interesting trend through PPPs. I think that's hugely powerful. In relation to the value of education, Sakharopoulos is the main researcher who's done research on private rates of return to different mm-hmm. levels of education. It's an interesting place to go to look at that, although some of it's it becomes out of date as soon as you do it, because returns are so it's all longitudinal stuff. But the one thing we haven't talked about are the non-financial returns, and in poorer countries. The stats are absolutely ridiculous. Education is a health intervention. Mm-hmm. You know, it's extraordinary that you're like, mm-hmm. and it's health not just for you, but child mortality for your own children. Reduced child mortality, reduced HIV, AIDS infection. The stats are absolutely extraordinary. And lastly, about the point about the skills and knowledge, my feeling, having been in education for all my career, is that the more you can move away from potentially a false dichotomy of whether education should be about schools or whether at skills or knowledge, the better. It has to be about both. You need knowledge to be able to develop skills, and you need skills for living a successful life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. We'll take a few more questions and then wrap up. Yes, gentleman here, and then in the orange shirt, and then on the other side in the very back, please.
Dan Silverstein, Heuristic Management. Dr. Petrino, you talked about coordinating donor funding and projects. Who's going to do that?
Good, succinct question. Yes, in the orange here.
Thank you. I'm Gia Cromer, PhD student at George Mason University in public policy. My research area interest is on criminality, and since secondary education is a lot of the age group that tends to kind of go off the rails into bad activities, I was wondering if in the work that you all have done, if you have any research that shows the effects that you're having, especially the gentleman who's started an innovative school with PEAS. And then there's a couple of other areas I was hoping that would be addressed, so I'll just name them quickly. Parental involvement and or community involvement with engagement in the schools, whether or not decentralization is actually the best thing from a societal construct, when most of a lot of African societies are rather centralized in nature, and also regarding curriculum regulation. And who's coming up with the curriculum for public-private partnership. And I guess it goes to the gentleman's point about government oversight and coordination. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Great. I'm not sure we can get to all of those, but we'll try. Yes, in the back.
Cheers. Thank you. Hi. Hi, Anna Smith, U.S. Department of Education. Thank you all for a great conversation. My question is about something that's come up a couple times of what works in education. And as you know, we at the department have this What Works Clearinghouse, where we're trying to invest in evaluation of interventions, teacher preparation programs, school design models, principal evaluation, a whole host of persistently challenging parts of what's needed to scale all of these things in primary, secondary, or vocational education. I'd love to hear from you all if, in your experiences, is anyone doing this well? I think we, at the department are still very early on in understanding how to do this and have rigorous evaluations to identify not just a particular model that works or a particular charter school that works, but the actual facets of an education system that can be scaled, because I think that's ultimately our goal. Thank you.
Great. Okay, so we have coordination, criminality, decentralization, curriculum regulation, and what works.
We can pick like a menu.
pick like a menu. I'll take a little of this and a little of that.
So since Peter mentioned donor coordination, I'll pass on that one. And on the criminality issue, I think the research that I know of is mostly from the United States, and we've seen very high returns to ECD, early childhood development programs, in reducing criminal activities in the future. What we've also seen from that same research is that the longer you wait to address these issues, the less likely you are to be successful. But not to say we shouldn't do it, but the highest returns seem to be at the early education level. On parental involvement and decentralization, I think on decentralization, education usually follows. So there's usually trends that countries have taken to move public administration closer to citizens. Education follows. One of the things we found after decades of research is kind of an obvious one, that locations that had lower capacity don't do as well as those other locations that had higher capacity, and it tends to increase the gap unless action's taken. So I spent most of my operational career at the bank working in Mexico, which had a huge decentralization in 1992, but they implemented with a compensatory program, talking about education, where they gave those states and schools within those states extra resources and training to address some of these issues, and they did it quite successfully. So decentralization can work, but we have to take into account those initial conditions and to make sure that mechanisms are in place. And one of those mechanisms is the parental involvement. So we saw that in Mexico, involving the parental committees, instead of PTAs, the parent associations, involving them in some level of decision making. It doesn't even have to be educational, but something at the school level increases their participation. It also increases the participation of their children, mm-hmm. In terms of doing the school work. It also increases things like teacher presence. So absenteeism went down in those schools. It increases teacher attention to the lowest performing schools, so the gap between the lowest and highest scores decreased over time. And we did see that many of these schools graduated from a very low level that required significant assistance to very close to the national average for Mexico, which was a huge accomplishment. So there is a huge amount of research on parental program decentralization, which is part of our program to generate evidence on what works in education. And to the question on what works, I think the main challenge now is, now that we have so much evidence about programs and schools, the question is, how do we scale this up so that it works? And I think that's the next generation of evaluation studies that we need, because right now we're learning a lot about individual programs, but we're not answering the question of external validity and what it takes to scale up these programs. There are many different organizations, including the the clearinghouse that was mentioned that are collecting this information, whether it's from MIT, Poverty Labs, or Campbell and others who are collecting this information. We need to come together on this. I haven't seen that yet, but that is definitely a need to those who are collecting the evidence and aggregating it to do it together. And many of the lessons that might be useful for the United States or other advanced countries could also be applied in middle and low income countries. And similarly, there might be things that work in developing countries that could work in high income countries. We learned from the research on the conditional cash transfer programs, and that's been applied in New York City, it's been applied in Australia and many other places. 30 countries have followed the conditional cash transfer model, mainly because of good research that was disseminated on how the program works, in addition to whether it works.
Yeah, Peter, please.
So since I raised the donor coordination.
Actually, I raised the issue and foisted it on you. So,
you know, the fact of the matter is most times it doesn't happen. I mean, that's the problem. And so I think it's a question of somebody stepping forward and taking the initiative. And that can be any number of players. I mean, the example I gave in Tanzania where it's BG in this whole LNG network. It can be a donor. It can be the government. So I think the critical element is that it happened, but you're right. It's a problem, and somebody needs to take the initiative to make sure it does happen. Just two other points I want to mention. On the issue of what works, there's also a related, although different, initiative being undertaken by the World Bank on youth employment and looking at youth employment. So this is not education-focused per se, but it's looking at the whole set of issues related to what works in youth employment, which has obviously both the supply side of education and training and what's working there, and then what we haven't talked about in that area is the demand side of are there jobs and is the private sector engaged and those kinds of things. So there's a World Bank initiative called Solutions for Youth Employment looking at that whole area of what works in terms of youth employment programs. And then finally, I just want to emphasize, and this relates a little bit to the question about criminality also, the whole issue of social emotional learning, non-cognitive skills. John talked about education being about both knowledge and skills. You know, we tend to think of skills traditionally as technical, and yet I think there's more and more evidence saying that the social emotional non-cognitive skills are as, if not more important for success in school, success in life, success in the workplace. So that's an element where I think we need to give increasing attention to both measuring and developing effective programs so that those skills are actually taught in schools and in other environments.
Great. And John, since you were the reason we all came together, I give you the last word. No pressure.
Just one word? Or?
No, five, six.
I think as interesting as the question about what works is the issue of what doesn't work. And a lot of the time, non-educationists especially, mm-hmm. have a very odd sense about what works when it actually doesn't work. And I think there's huge amounts of research about things like the number of kids per classroom being largely an irrelevance compared to other types of changes to inputs, for example. And that's really important that we spread understanding of that. Obviously, in a classroom level, John Hattie is done some amazing stuff on meta-analysis of what classroom interventions seem to work in very large numbers of different contexts. Things like assessment for learning is critical, going back to Harry's earlier point about if the teacher knows whether what they're doing is working, then, or not, as the case may be, that's critical information. And across the world, there's a massive gap between what teachers have and what they need to have. So that definitely works. I won't go through loads of them, but John Hattie's a great place to go for that information. And the last thing I'd say is peas. So that's my last word.
That's your last word. Peas. Peas, everybody. All right. Thank you very much for being with us. Really appreciate it. Thank you for coming.